Hi, everyone. Welcome to Nancy's Metaphysical World and More. My name is Nancy, and I host the show. And today I have a great guest on. His name is Gerald. He has quite a story to talk about, and so we're going to bring him on right away. So, Gerald, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, Gerald, let's do this so people know who you are. Let's tell them a little bit about who you are and some of the things that you've been doing, and then I'm just going to ask you some questions to help bring out some more information. So go ahead and let them know who you are.
Well, I'm Gerald Anderson, and I'm an eyewitness to a UFO crash on the plains of San Augustine on July 4th, 1947. And I got involved with ufology, I guess that's a correct term, back in the early 90s when I saw a deal on Unsolved Mysteries that was basically telling the story that I had witnessed, but they had it all wrong. So I called the number on there, and the gal said, well, how do you know it's not right? And I said, well, because I was there, and it's not right. And so she put me in touch with some investigators, and I've been involved in it ever since.
Yeah, and it's really funny, Joe, because when somebody says that they have seen a UFO crash, two things happen to you. One, you have the FBI, the men in black, everybody trying to breathe down your throat, and then you have the normal everyday people going, oh, yeah, you probably had too much to drink or, you know, may have been dreaming. Is that what you went through?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, when you make an unusual claim, you really got to have unusual evidence. If I were to tell you that I walked out on my porch this morning and saw a herd of deer eating my tulips, you probably wouldn't have a problem with that. But if I said to you that I saw a couple of unicorns out there eating my tulips, even if I was to bring one in on a halter, you'd accuse me of genetic engineering. So, you know, yeah, it goes with the territory, trust me.
So when you saw, let's talk about this crash. It was in 1947. And where exactly was the crash at?
Well, it was, I can't give you the exact location because I'm kind of under a shroud of secrecy there at this particular time because of the researchers I'm involved with now, but it is south of Dattle, New Mexico, on the plains of San Augustine, New Mexico.
Okay, and I live in New Mexico.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I said I live in New Mexico. I live in Las Lunas, so I was out by Dattle about 2 or 3 months ago, but that's before I really knew all the stuff about what went on out there. So, you know, go ahead and keep talking.
Well, we had arrived in New Mexico on the 3rd of July, 1947. I was just a kid, you know, I was like 5 years old. And we had moved out there because a lot of my father's family lived there because they actually homesteaded in Roy, New Mexico back in the early 1900s. And so all of his brothers were out there, and they had been telling him that, you know, if he was to come to New Mexico, that he could probably get on with the Atomic Energy Commission because my dad was a tool and die maker, a master machinist. And we had, the way I understand the story was that they expected like a 5-year waiting period before they'd even talk to you. But we moved out there, and we're staying at my Uncle Guy's place in downtown Albuquerque, which is on, I believe, North 2nd at the time. And it was the 4th of July. It was a holiday. And my Uncle Ted was married to a lady whose brother lived in Magdalena. And we were just kind of going out on the holiday, you know, meeting that part of the family that we had never met before. And in the process, John Trujillo, which was Aunt Isabel's brother, was a miner at Magdalena. And I don't know if I'm correct on this or not, but I believe there were silver mines out there or something. But anyways, it being a holiday, he was, you know, off. And he didn't have to go to work until midnight, so we had gone down there very early in the morning to meet these people. And my brother was home on leave from the Marine Corps. And he was he later became a geologist. At the time, he was like a rock hound. You know, he was really interested in anything that was in the form of a rock. And he had asked John if he knew of any place where there was banded agates and moss agates and stuff like that. And John said to Uncle Ted, well, you know, there's a lot of agates out there by where you guys hunt for antelope and stuff out on the plains. Well, since he had to go to work at midnight that night, we, bid our farewell, and we all went on out toward Dattle and out to this area that they hunted in. And when we got there, you know, we're walking down this area, down this arroyo, toward the area where they normally hunted, where they believed this agates and stuff was at. And when we came around a corner in the bend of the arroyo, here's a silver disc that's impacted in a ridgeline. And there's four individuals out there, and I guess you could call them creatures. And I remember my brother and everybody saying, you kids stay here. You know, while I was talking to my cousin Victor and me, we're about the same age, and of course you're not going to tell five-year-old kids to stay put in a situation like this. And the adults went on down toward what they thought was a crash of an airplane, and then my brother made the statement that that's not an airplane, that's a, and I won't use the word, is a GD spaceship. And when we got down there, there was this silver disc and these four creatures laying there that definitely were not human, and in spite of what the Air Force says, they were not anthropomorphic dummies, because those things were like 6 foot tall. These things were the size of my cousin and myself.
Which makes a big difference.
Beg your pardon?
I said then that makes a big difference in their size. I mean, because there's a lot of different stories that are told to people, and everybody's assuming that they're grays, and they're huge, but that's not true. They all come in different sizes, don't they?
Well, these did. I was like 5 years old, and my cousin Victor was just a little bit older than me, and these creatures were about the same size we were. And to be truthfully honest with you, Nancy, when we first walked up there, I honestly thought I was looking at dolls until they started moving. Okay? And it became abundantly clear to me at that point in time that these aren't dolls. They're alive. There was two of them laying on what looked like really dull-looking foil material, and they weren't moving. And there was another one laying next to them, was writhing around on the ground. And the only description I can give you of that is I believe that creature was in pain. And then there was one of them sitting next to it, kind of cross-legged. And there were some open containers there with material in it that looked like some of the material that was already applied to this one that was writhing around. I to this day, I believe it was trying to give it first aid. When we first walked up on them, this thing reacted in total fear. I think it expected us to hurt it. And, of course, my Uncle Ted spoke fluent Spanish. My brother Glenn and my dad, of course, only spoke English. And they were trying to communicate with it, and it kept looking back and forth between the three of them, and, you know, with no recognition at all on its face. If I don't know what the recognition on their face would look like, but it appeared that it was not understanding what they said.
What did they look like, other than dolls? Did they have big eyes, little eyes?
Their heads were very large, and they had these huge almond-shaped eyes. And this is one of the things that got me in trouble during one of the original interviews with some of these researchers. They were very dark eyes, and I made the statement that they... there was a murky blue sheen to their eyes. Well, it immediately came up that I said their eyes were blue. I didn't say that. If you've ever been out in the high desert, and since you live in Las Vegas, New Mexico, you probably know exactly what I'm saying. Anything shiny black gives off a murky blue sheen in desert sunlight. And that's what I said to this researcher. Well, it came up then that I said their eyes were blue. Their eyes were not blue. They were shiny black with a murky blue sheen. And their skin, they had very large heads. And their skin looked honestly like gray glove leather, you know, like you'd see on a porpoise.
Okay.
And they were very slender creatures. Their hands were, they had like five fingers on their hands, except the two center fingers were much longer than the other ones. And I one time I told Stanton Friedman that I thought they would have made excellent violinists with those long fingers. They were wearing one-pieced, what looked like flight uniforms. And they had sort of a maroon piping on them, and they were a silvery material, and they were all one piece, down complete with the footwear. You understand what I mean? All one piece.
Yep.
And after a while, this thing kind of calmed down. And I don't know, I had got under, you know, this thing was impacted in the ridgeline at kind of an angle, and it was kind of shady under there. And being from Indiana, from the Midwest, I was not used to this intense heat of the high desert. And I had moved under that area where it was shady, and it was intensely cold under there, like you were inside of a freezer unit. And for some reason, to this day, I don't understand why, I reached down and touched one of those doll-like creatures, and I guess I realized that it was dead, you know, and it scared me, and I ran around behind my Uncle Ted and my dad and was looking between them at this creature. And it just kind of suddenly looked me straight in the eye, and I don't know, all kinds of things started happening at a point. Like I felt like an impact, followed by a couple more impacts, and it scared me, and I ran back across the arroyo and up on this small ridgeline to the, this would be the kind of northeast of there, probably about 20, 25 yards. And was looking back down at the scene, and I could see a lot of dust trails out on the playa, out on the plains out there. And it was like vehicles moving. And then I seen a gray pickup truck with a big whip antenna pull up just above the ridgeline where this thing was impacted. And a man got out that, for all practical purposes, looked like a very tall Harry Truman. And of course, you know, even to a 5-year-old in 1947, everybody knew what Harry Truman looked like. This is the guy that won the war, you know, and he wore that Stetson and had those round glasses, and this guy looked exactly like him. And so I went back down there, and he had walked down to, was talking to the adults. And I remember him saying that he worked out there and that he made maps. And they were all talking and trying to communicate with this thing. And then there was a bunch of people that came up the arroyo. And it was a professor and a bunch of students, the graduate students, apparently were working over at Bat Cave on some kind of excavation over there. And they said that they had seen this thing come down the night before. But they thought it was a meteorite. Until one of them in the party said, that can't be a meteorite, doctor, because it turned. Meteorites don't turn. Well, the next morning when the sun came up, they could see the shiny metal across the playa. And they had walked all the way across the plains, which is in itself no small feat. It's quite a ways across there. And they showed up, and they hadn't been there but just, maybe 15, 20 minutes, and the military swarmed the place. It was like an invasion force, and they all had guns, and they all had bad attitudes.
And so did they take the craft? And
I'm sorry?
Did the military take the craft and everything that was there?
Well, I do not know. All I know is this, that they started pointing guns at all of us and kind of herded us all into one group and were very aggressive. There were in the staff car that was, there was a, like a six-by, you know what I mean by a six-by truck? It
mm-hmm.
was the old military transport truck that had the canvas over the back end of it.
Right.
And then there was a staff car. And in this staff car, the guy that got out of there was this red-headed officer whose name was Armstrong. And I don't know if I know that from having been told that or reading that on his uniform, but anyways, his name was Armstrong. And it was a black sergeant with him, which in 1947 was pretty rare.
Mm-hmm.
And they were giving orders, and this guy, this red-headed captain, had a really nasty attitude. And he was threatening people, and these guys were all wearing MP bands on their arms.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pushing people away from the craft and away from the creature, and the creature went crazy at this point. I mean, it was calm prior to this, and then it wasn't calm anymore. And one of these soldiers had shoved this Grand Rifle, and I know it's a Grand Rifle because I was in the military and used them, shoved this my Uncle Ted, and my Uncle Ted was one of those kind of guys that wouldn't take that kind of thing, and he smacked this guy in the face, and it had not been for my brother and my dad, I think the other MPs would have shot him. Because everything got really crazy at that point. And anyways, they got him back, and we were ordered off into a group and escorted back out toward the highway, which at the time was nothing but a dirt road, okay, that went from Dattle in this direction. And our car was parked out there. And they summarily put us in a car and told us to leave and do not come back. And they told my parents, my dad and my brother, and my Uncle Ted, they said, if you want to see your kids again, you keep your mouth shut or you'll be put under the prison. You'll never see them again. Go that way and don't look back. Well, I remember as we were driving away, we were in a 40 Plymouth. And I don't know if you've ever seen a 40 Plymouth. Man, oh man, what a lead sled. Had a back window, and I was looking out the back window of this thing, and I could see that professor, as we were driving away, was arguing, or apparently arguing with that red-headed captain and pointing back across the plains. And I assume at least tried to tell them that they had to go back over there and they weren't being allowed to or something. I'm not sure. But we went back to Dattle and back to Albuquerque. And over the preceding years, you know, we would every once in a while encounter people that would ask us if we had ever opened our mouths about what we saw out there. And, you know, we were expecting like 5 years before my father would have been, you know, even interviewed for a job at the tech area at Sandia Base. Well, it was less than 6 months and he was hired, which always seemed kind of strange to me. And being a dependent of someone who worked for the Atomic Energy Commission, we had ID cards. And you had to wear them anytime you were on Sandia Base, but you had, you know, access to everything, the swimming pools and the theaters and stuff like that. And, you know, to have access to a swimming pool in New Mexico in the summertime is a real plus.
Yes.
So a lot of us kids, you know, we would ride our bicycles to the west gate of Sandia Base, and they would see the ID cards and they'd pass everybody through until they seen mine. And then invariably I would be stopped and questioned, have you opened your mouth about what you saw, yada, 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 what does your dad do here? And you know, you learn very early on in life to say, well, why don't you ask my dad? You
mm-hmm.
know, it became intense. And a lot of times, you know, my dad would be transferred to Los Alamos to do something. And we would be living up there for a while. And these not-so-smart people would pull up in a staff car. You know, the kids all had to go to school in groups. You know, you couldn't go by yourself. And they would get out, and, you know, not-so-smart individuals would start questioning, you know, what does your dad do? You know, why don't you ask my dad? And it just went on like that year after year after year until it just finally quieted down and it stopped. And even after I guess you could say, came out of the closet with this, I still haven't had anybody come to me and start asking me about it. I've been called everything from a liar to a charlatan to a pathological liar, and that the site's bogus and all of that, you know. But basically, that's in a nutshell.
So while you were there and you saw them, did you get any kind of like any material or anything that came from that ship? Did anybody take anything from there? Do you know?
Well, there was this one young girl. And we think her name may have been Agnes Shedlevsky. And she was apparently one of the students with the archaeological group. And when I say apparently, it's, we had done an identikit sketch of this gal when I was working with Stanton. And because he had talked to some hospice worker that the woman that she was working with who was dying of cancer had told her this story. Mm-hmm. So we did an identikit sketch, and a professor at the university, her name was Judith Fowler, aged it to look like a person who was dying of cancer. Okay, when the hospice worker seen the identikit, she said, "Oh my God, that's Agnes." She spotted it immediately. Well, the reason that we did the identikit sketch is because during this exchange, when the students and the professor were up there, this young lady had walked up to this doctor, this professor who was in charge of the group. It has now been pretty solidly identified as a guy by the name of Professor Dick from, I believe, don't quote me on this, but I believe it's the University of Pennsylvania. But anyways, she said, "Look at this. Doctor, wouldn't this make a beautiful ring?" And it was a piece of, looked like a ruby-colored glass rod with kind of a silvery coating on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And he just really almost bit her head off, said, "Put that down, throw that away. You don't, that could be radioactive. Get rid of that. Don't touch that." Well, and he turned around and was, again, was talking to my brother. And she kind of did an eye roll and stuck it in the pocket and walked off. And so she was probably the only one that had anything from the original crash site, okay? However, 2 years ago, Art Campbell and Chuck Wade and a group of Navajo laborers went out and excavated this area, and they found material out there that has some pretty strange properties. Now, last June, this previous June, we were all out there again. It was Chuck and his wife, Nancy, Kara Faye, who is a filmmaker, a gal by the name of Jenny, who's a biologist, and a guy from the Roswell Military Institute, who is a geologist. We all had metal detectors with us. Because I've been maintaining for years, you know, they couldn't possibly have got everything. So we took metal detectors out there, and we came up with 12 pieces of material, metal material, that are currently under laboratory analysis, and only one of the 12 has been analyzed, but it's really strange stuff. The aluminum content is very high. There's a lot of magnesium in it. But the strange part is there's a lot of iron in it, in clusters. and it's free-floating, apparently, from what I understand. And again, I'm not a physicist and I'm not a geologist, but the way it was explained to me is that it's not possible for an alloy to that like that to be manufactured outside of a pure vacuum, because if it was terrestrial, the iron globules would have settled to the bottom or floated to the top. And these are in suspension inside the material. So according to these physicists and geologists and metallurgists, that's impossible. It had to be done in a pure vacuum. So, we don't know how it was done. Mm-hmm. And they can't identify it, but that's what the laboratory analysis is showing. And we had 12 samples that we picked up. We kind of got the idea, see, there was two impact points. There was the initial impact point where it landed and bounced over a small ridgeline, impacted an arroyo, skidded across the arroyo, and rammed itself into a ridge. Well, the first of the material that we found was in that ridge, and it was around rodent nests. There's a lot of pack rats in there, mm-hmm. In these boulder areas. And one thing we found out from the biologists, that pack rats, when they build their tunnels, they like to have clear tunnels for escape to get away from snakes and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's anything in there, they'll try to move it to the surface. Well, that was where we found the first piece of what looks like honeycombed aluminum material that has these strange properties to it. And then we went back up to that first impact point, and there's a lot of prairie dog towns up there. And we found 11 more sites up there, you know, pieces of mm-hmm. metal that's up there, and it's obviously been recontoured. You could actually see the contour line along this, these pinon pines that are growing in a straight line where everything else isn't doing that. And we found 11 more pieces of metal up there that are currently under laboratory analysis. Apparently, the military thought they had it buried forever, and over the years, you know, it's about 60 years now, that, or 60 years plus now, that erosion has brought this stuff to the surface, so the prairie dogs have moved it out of their tunnels.
Do you, the people that are testing this, are they an independent lab?
Yes, they are, and we've used them before. It's a friend of Chuck Wade's, who Chuck is an engineer, and he has a friend who runs a laboratory. And I, for the life of me, I cannot tell you what the guy's name is, but I've got the Chuck has sent me the laboratory analysis on email. I could probably copy them and send them to you if you'd like to see them.
I think it'd be interesting.
They are independent laboratories, and he is not the only one that's doing it. For security reasons, Chuck has only said that this one guy's doing it, but I know for a fact there's three other laboratories mm-hmm. that are doing it independently that are not publicized at this time.
Yeah, which doesn't, you know, which is a good idea, and it's good it's not publicized. Since you guys keep going back and forth and you keep finding things, have you been harassed by anybody since then?
No, not at all. Which actually, I was kind of surprised, to be truthfully honest with you. The last time we did this was in June, and. Of course, we were staying at the Eagle Guest Ranch there in Dattle, and the sidewalks that they don't have in Dattle, they roll up at about 5 at night. Well, everybody had already gone home. Kara and her biologist and her film crew had gone back to Las Vegas, and Nancy and Chuck had gone back to Gallup, and the geologist has gone back to Roswell. So I was the only one at the guest ranch, and this would have been the perfect time to harass me and change my point of view, but I'm sitting on the porch out there drinking a glass of wine, enjoying life, and never saw another living soul except for the fire crews, you know, that kept going past on the way to Alpine, Arizona to try to put that fire out that was out mm-hmm. there. But no, nobody's harassed me.
That's probably a good thing.
The nice thing about this from the government standpoint is they really don't have to do anything, you know. There's enough naysayers out there to attack my character and attack the character of the labs and Chuck and everybody else. They really don't need to do anything, you know. They'll stir up enough stink that, you know, if you don't lead the unicorn in on a harness, you're not going to go anywhere with it.
Which is true. Now, out there by Seattle someplace, because, like I said, I've only been out there once, and it was just a kind of a quick thing, and I wasn't out there looking for any UFOs or anything, but they have all these satellite dishes out there.
Oh, you're talking about the VLA?
Yeah. What is that?
Very large array?
Yeah. What is that?
Yeah. Excuse me. That I chuckle every time I hear this thing about the VLA because I thought it was ironic that they put that installation in within 15 miles of the crash site, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, that's kind of odd. And so, you know, and I have stopped at the visitor center out there at the VLA because I'm fascinated by that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked to some of the technicians and scientists out there, and I said, why is it here? Why is it right here? Of all the god-awful places in the world. And they said, well, because there is very little light here. Well, okay, I'm not a scientist, but I'm also not stupid.
mm-hmm.
Radio telescopes are not going to have a problem with light. Okay?
Right.
Not going to happen. Radio telescopes work completely different than light telescopes do. So, okay, so there's not a lot of light here. Are we talking about some kind of electromagnetic influence? Maybe that's what you're trying to get away from, or photon influence from light? Well, they wouldn't answer the question. So I'm thinking, okay, what's going on here? So flash back to the 50th anniversary when I had the opportunity to sit down for 2.5 hours over supper with Colonel Corso, who wrote a book about the back engineering on the debris that was taken from the San Augustine crash site. I didn't believe the guy at first until he told me exactly what I was wearing that day at that crash site. And I looked him straight in the eye, and I said, Colonel, how do you know I was wearing that? And how do you know that I had zinc oxide over my nose to protect me from the sunburn that I had developed? And he said, because the creature told me so. And I said, the creature told you this? He said, yeah, the creature was taken along with the crash debris and the bodies to Los Alamos. I spent 18 months with the creature. We learned to communicate with its home world. Then it got sick. We didn't understand its physiology, and it died on us. But he described the exact clothing I was wearing that day. And if he was not present at the crash site, then he had to get that information from somebody else. And
that
pretty much made the hair on the back of my neck stand up.
And it would make anybody's hair stand up. You know, there's a lot of secrecy here in New Mexico. I came from the Chicagoland area. You talked about Indiana. I came from the Chicagoland area. But where I live, I actually live in Los Lunas. And I'm the last house to the mountains, to the Manzano Mountain. So there's always a lot of strange things going on in the sky out here, which is great. I love it. But, you know, I've only been here for about, it was 2 years this last April, so not very long.
Uh-huh.
But in that 2 years, I've met a lot of people, and a lot of people have talked about all the cover-ups going on between Aztec, Dulce, Los Alamos, Sandia Labs, Kirkland Air Force Base, and White Sands Military Base.
Right.
And there's people who talk about it and I actually did a conference this last April called Wake Up Now Conference, and I had people that are from New Mexico at the conference who talked about it, and I find it very interesting. One of my things is to go to Dulce, because to me, Dulce is a fake town, and that's supposed to be an underground ET base, but I don't know if that's true or not. You know, so stuff like that. But going out by Dabble, where you're talking about, in Magdalena, there is a mountain there. It's called the Ladrone Peak. Have you heard of that?
Yeah. And okay. There's a weather station on top of it.
Well, there's something there. But from
understanding... it's called a weather station, but there is definitely a facility up there. And if you try to go up there, you will be turned around.
Well, because I actually hike, I've hiked up 7,200 feet on that mountain, but it's 9,200 feet, so I've not made it to the top yet. But that mountain, is the base of it, is made out of white quartz crystals. It's fascinating.
Yes,
and
it is.
And the energy is fascinating. And the
now, you want to hear something else that's fascinating. You live in Los Lenas.
Right.
If you turn and look east toward the Manzano Mountains, there's four mountains there. They kind of look like the ends of watermelons sticking out of the ground.
Okay.
Are you familiar with what I'm talking about, what they call the four hills?
No, but I'll look into that, so go ahead.
Okay. If you know where the Big Sandia, Small Sandia, then Tierras Canyon...
Mm-hmm.
Which is Interstate 40 runs through Tierras Canyon. Okay,
right.
The next mountain south of there looks like a watermelon, end of a watermelon sticking out of the ground.
Okay.
Directly behind that mountain is Manzano Secret Base. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And if you go there and get on Interstate 40, well, get on the old road, the old 66 road that goes up the canyon.
Uh-huh.
Just stop and look at the base of that mountain. You will see four fences that looks like a super highway going around the bottom of that mountain. Okay? Those fences have roads between them, and those fences are alternately lethal fences, electric fences.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the base of the mountain, you will see concrete bunkers what look like tunnels.
Okay.
Behind that mountain is Manzano Secret Base. And inside that mountain down, I think, I was told one time it was 2,400 feet, which is awfully deep. And having been a miner at one time, I'm not exactly sure I'd want to be down there with that kind of pressure rock. But nonetheless, it's the largest nuclear weapons repository in the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
It's a storage facility, and they got housing developments all around this thing. And on the back side of that mountain is a base. And there, if you look at your aeronautical charts, it very plainly says prohibited area. You don't fly over that baby. Even commercial airliners don't do it. When they lift off the east-west runway at Albuquerque International, they will immediately do right or left traffic. They will not fly over that mountain. There's a reason. The aeronautical charts say prohibited area, no overflights, period. And isn't it interesting that all over the Small Sandia and the Big Sandia, there's VADAM sites. That stands for Viking Anti-Aircraft Ballistic Missile Sites. VADAMs. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
They were all over those mountains. They're all abandoned now, but they used to be air defense missile sites, Vikings. Now, if there's nothing going on there, why you got all these Viking missile sites out there?
That would be true.
Yeah, and then you got Lassiter Range out there, which was top secret area where they did all kinds of strange experimentation. I remember one time I had gotten to the point I was so sick of being interrogated by the military police every time I tried to go to the swimming pool that this one young soldier says, "Man, what does your dad do? Does your dad work here? You're AEC dependent." I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "What does your dad do?" And I said, "I don't know. Maybe he makes atomic bombs. I don't know." next thing I knew, I was under arrest, taken to the military police barracks. My poor dad was pulled out of the tech area and pulled down there. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm dead. You know, my dad is just going to kill me. That's all there is to it. Well, you know, I was scared to death. And my dad wasn't all that happy. And there was this colonel. I think he was a full bird colonel. Nice guy. He said, why did you tell that MP that? And I said, because I'm so sick of them interrogating me. They let my friends go, but they'll keep me there for 10, 15 minutes asking me all kinds of questions that I don't have answers to. And I got sick of it. And he said, well, young man, from now on, keep your mouth shut. Mr. Anderson, you can go back to the tech area. Everything's okay. And young man, go on to the swimming pool. And the MPs actually took me to the swimming pool. But, I mean, that's the kind of crap that went on, you know. So,
well, it is.
They were plus, watching this.
Plus, I've heard that. Plus, I've heard that by Kirkland Military Base, Air Force Base, they've actually hollowed out a lot of the Manzano Mountains and have, again, a lot of studies going on there that they don't want too many people to know about.
Oh, yeah. Well, that secret base back there, there's some strange stuff going on back there. And you can't get within a mile of it, you know, without running into signs that say, do not trespass U.S. government property, authorization to use deadly force. So, I mean, that's a shoot-on-sight instructions. And at one time, I had worked for Safeguard System when I first got out of the military, and I worked as a security guard at Lassiter Range. And we had orders to shoot on-site anybody that wasn't supposed to be there between the close of business hours and the opening of business hours the next day. And that went from 2000 hours, which was 8 o'clock, to 0700 hours the next morning. We had orders to shoot on site anybody in that facility. I didn't last very long there.
Maybe six months.
I worked for Safeguard and said, I can't do this. And I was a young man at the time, too, and I would have rather worked in the daytime so I could party with the girls at night. You know what I'm saying?
Yep. I understand that. Now, you also, you're a stay-at-home dad, right? Have been a stay-at-home
dad. Oh, yeah, I'm retired and I'm loving it.
Which is a good thing. But you also have done a lot of different things with solar. Is that true?
With what?
Using solar.
Oh, yeah. Well, I hopefully I've got the only free-range rolling solar-powered chicken coop in southwest Missouri.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I got Harbor Freight puts out a 45-watt, 24-volt, three-panel solar screen with a controller and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got it mounted on a platform with wheels on it. And, of course, the chicken coop's got wheels on it. And there's a predator fence around it to keep foxes and stuff away from my birds because I'm a vegetarian. My wife and I are both vegetarians. Lacto-ovo vegetarians. And we kind of depend on the, you know, the chickens to keep us some feed.
Mm-hmm.
And so we moved this thing around, you know, all over the pasture. And the predator fence and the fans inside the chicken coop, because trust me, it's been anywhere from 105 to 111 degrees for the past 3.5 weeks here. It
mm-hmm.
has been unbelievably hot. But the solar panels keep the fans going in the chicken coop and keeps the predator fence alive, and my chickens are happy, and that makes me happy.
How did you come up with that?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's one of those brain things. You know, you get this quirk in your head all of a sudden. I wanted to do some free-range chicken coops because we have two chicken coops, one in a permanent mounted area. And the chickens have a tendency to tear an area up pretty good. And we got 4.25 acres out there, a really nice pasture. And I thought, you know, if they had a chicken coop that could be moved around, that would be cool. So I got on the internet and found this A-frame chicken coop that has four, you can mount four wheels to it. You can take them off and put them on whenever you want to move it. And you just move it like every 3 or 4 days. And that fertilizes the field. It's kind of one of those green things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to thinking, well, you know, what's going to happen come wintertime? How am I going to keep these guys happy and or these girls happy? So I got to thinking about solar applications, and then it suddenly dawned on me, well, there's a way to have the lights when, you know, come fall, you got to have a little bit more light per day or they'll stop laying on you. Mm-hmm. And in the heat of the summer, this will keep them ventilated. And I need a predator fence. Well, if you use a deep cycle 12-volt marine battery, this thing will run a predator fence for like 2.5 months before you have to recharge the battery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the solar screen has another battery with it that is running the fans through an inverter, 120-volt inverter, and it's keeping that battery charged up. So when the other battery gets down, you just swap out batteries and you're back in business. And it works.
It's kind of interesting.
Kind of a mad scientist thing, but it works.
That's all right. Mad scientist stuff works. Probably works better than anything. Are you planning on coming back to New Mexico at any time?
Well, I'm not sure, but I, you know, every year in October,
mm-hmm.
we have the UFO Film Festival in Gallup.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck puts it on. Chuck and Nancy puts it on, and I've been out there every year for the past 5 years, so yeah, probably in October I'll be in Gallup again.
That's kind of cool. Maybe I'll go to
that. I'm very fond of Gallup. In fact, my wife and I have spent 12 years as National Outings Trip Leaders for the Sierra Club in Canyon de Chelly, Arizona. We lead groups into the canyon with Navajo guides, and so this is kind of old home territory, you know. We got a lot of Navajo friends, and we spent a lot of years out there going into Canyon de Chelly and being around Gallup and everything. So it's really nice to go back every October. So, yeah, I'll probably be back there. And hang on a minute. Hey, knock it off. My dogs are doing things.
I can hear them.
And I'll be back out there in October for sure.
Okay, maybe I'll get to go to that one. Now, let's. We only have a couple minutes left before our time's up. So
Okay. You
talked about the Navajos. Now, from what I understand, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the Navajos, the Hopis, and the Zunis all know about a place for entering a hollow earth right there. Do you know anything about that?
I have heard about that, and I'm really not that familiar with it, but what I understand is it's like a power vortex, and it's right around that Canyon de Chelly, Arizona area, outside of Chin Lee, and it's up in Monument Canyon. But there's supposed to be a very strong power vortex there, and they honestly believe that you can, you know, go interdimensionally there somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Most of the Navajo singers won't talk about it because they think that you've got to be, for lack of a better term, certified to know that information.
Mm-hmm.
I have heard about it, and I understand it's in Monument Canyon somewhere, but I don't know anything else about it beyond that.
Okay. Well, you know, for the crash, and now your dad's not around. He is around, or he's not around. Did your dad already die?
Oh, yeah. My brother Glenn passed away in Mexico City in 1981, and my father passed away in 1978. Ted and Victor, my Uncle Ted and my cousin Victor, were killed in an automobile crash years before that. So basically, I'm the only one of the immediate family that's still alive and saw it.
Do you ever talk to any of the other people that were there that day?
No. Unless Colonel Corso himself was there. And honestly, I got a pretty good memory for faces. You know, once I see somebody's face, I'll recognize it 20 years from now, but I won't know who they are. I won't know their name. You know, I'm really terrible on names. It's like a curse with me. But I don't forget a face, and I don't remember having seen Colonel Corso there at the crash site that day. But he's the only one that I've talked to that really had an intimate knowledge of what happened out there that day. And when I say intimate, when you can stand there and look me straight in the face and tell me exactly what I was wearing, you were either there or you talked to somebody who was there, you know.
Yeah. Now, are they making a film about this crash, do you know?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. Cara Faye. Bless her heart. She is the sweetest gal in the world. Love her dearly. She is putting together a documentary on this, and they were out there that day with the video cameras, videotaping everything. As we found these, we got these metal indications with the metal detectors.
Mm-hmm.
They were right there with still cameras and video cameras recording the whole thing, watching the process of digging the material up and all that. And she's building a very nice documentary out of this thing. And I don't know how far along she is on it, but it's going to be good. She's really good at what she does.
When you get more information about it and stuff, please let me know. And when you're going to come back, and you said you're going to be back in October, maybe I'll come down to that festival over there and we can meet face-to-face, and then I'll probably have some other stories to let you know what I've heard.
Okay, that would be wonderful. I would really look forward to that. And when I find out what the dates are, I'll email that information to you, and perhaps we can meet out there. That would be wonderful.
Great.
I think
that would be
Chuck
great.
Would absolutely love that.
Well, I'd like to interview Chuck, actually. So when you talk with him, tell him that I'm interested in interviewing him at some point in time. And
okay.
Then we'll get
I will
touch.
Do that. I will do
okay.
that.
Okay. It's been great
talking
with you.
Would you like me to send you copies of these lab reports?
Sure. I would be very interested in looking at them.
I will do that. I will do that. Now, if you're in the same boat I'm in, I'm looking at this and I'm really not understanding what I'm seeing. But what they have told me is that there's just no way outside of a pure vacuum that this could happen. I'm having to take their word for it because I'm not a theoretical physicist. And I basically understand Schrodinger's cat, but beyond that, I'm done.
Okay, well, Gerald, it's been great talking with you. Our time is actually up, but thank you for taking the time and talking and letting people know that, it's out there. They just have to keep looking for it. So thank you very much.
Well, you're most welcome, and thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And you send me out those emails, all right? And you take care, and we'll talk soon again.
All right, Nancy, you got it. And I'll get them to you as soon as I can. You have a
great
day. Huh?
You too. I'd like to thank you, the listeners. May God bless all of you. Have a great day and take care. Bye now.